and thank you for downloading Wax Lyrical, the advertising and marketing podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society. And I'm Mark Ranicus.
And I'm Ben Hooper. And in this episode, we'll be talking about sleep as we're joined by the leaders from one of the country's best known mattress brands, eSleep. We'll also be talking about their new campaign, in-housing creative work, and what it means to be distinctive. Plus, of course, finding out about their personal favourite ads of all time.
Well, first, I'd like to welcome Cheryl Calverley, CEO of eSleep. Before becoming CEO, Cheryl was Chief Marketing Officer at eSleep and has also held senior marketing roles at Unilever, Birds Eye Igloo and the AA. And I'm sure, Cheryl, you're an expert in consumer psychology because you graduated with a first in psychology from Goldsmiths. I'm feeling a bit nervous already. Welcome, Cheryl. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Yes, you should definitely be nervous.
And I'd also like to welcome Caroline Smith, Creative Director at eSleep. Caroline's creative journey began with a degree in industrial design before working agency side, then into the not-for-profit sector at the BHF, British Heart Foundation, as a senior marketing manager, and then working alongside Cheryl at the AA, where you were head of brand. Welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, good to be on this podcast.
So this is obviously a winning partnership because you guys have worked together before. But let's start with you, Cheryl. How does this partnership work for you? And why is it important to have someone with Caroline's skills in-house?
I mean, Caroline and I have got quite complementary skills, particularly, I think, from a creative point of view, I would say. So I'm quite good with words. Caroline's quite good with all things visual and beautiful. And if you could see our respective rooms on the Zoom call, I think you can probably see mine is a very plain room with a weights bench, and Caroline's is a gorgeous room with some fabulous art in the backdrop, and that kind of that brings the two of us together. So we work together at the AA, and actually, and you know, we've also got sort of quite complementary thought styles. I'm relatively big picture, sort of strategic, a bit, you know, off we go over there. Caroline's brilliant at going, right, well, what does that mean? How do you make that happen? And what are the parts of the puzzle that need to be done? And sort of keeps my feet on the ground on actually getting stuff to happen and to happen brilliantly, I think.
In-housing is obviously always a sort of a rumbling hot topic within the industry between agencies and brands and everyone talking. And there's obviously a huge sort of like, it's quite a complex conversation because you have in-housing for a product and a brand, and then you have in-housing for, say, sort of creating content or creating entertainment like the BBC or For Creative. How do you guys sort of make sure that you are keeping your eye on everything outside of the brand? Because I myself have been a client. I worked in-house at Red Bull for a number of years, and we did challenge ourselves to, and we found it difficult to sort of have a level of self-awareness around that's going on outside of the brand, because you can get lost in the world that you are creating. And sort of, Caroline, how do you make sure that you're sort of tapping into things outside of the business to make sure that it's culturally sort of like on in tune and is going to be sort of fresh and not too sort of self-indulgent?
So I think we have a genuine love of advertising, of the kind of the world around us generally. I think as a team and as a business, we're always kind of keeping an eye on what's going on outside of our own little bubble. It's really easy to be just constantly thinking about your own little bubble. So always keeping an eye on what other people are doing, whether it's in the UK or abroad, always thinking about, so we don't think about our category as just necessarily other mattress in a box brands. We think far more broadly, because everyone's competing for attention from consumers all the time. So I think a genuine love of all things around us and just inspiration from anywhere.
How do you staff around that? How do you make sure you bring in the right people? Because obviously you have a really interesting approach to working with agencies. You've created your own campaigns, and I know Mark's going to talk about that more in a bit, where you sort of cherry-pick various skills and sort of created your own sort of like campaign without having to sort of go to one particular agency. How are you finding staffing that sort of like, are you bringing people in sort of permanently, are you freelancing, or are you bringing agencies in at certain times, which you normally would have just gone given them the whole thing?
So we do a bit of both, really. So we have an in-house creative team, really small but kind of very, very nimble, really enthusiastic copywriter and designer who work day in, day out, really multi-skilled, and can kind of turn their hand to a ton of different things. But we also work with agencies. So we, when we know that we have kind of bigger, more strategic challenges, we will go externally. You know, if we're creating stuff for Above the Line, then almost always we'd go externally to agencies. But and then we have a roster of freelancers, because it's really difficult when you're in a small business to have an in-house team who can do everything. So, for example, at the moment, I'm doing a lot of work on packaging and kind of branding. I couldn't have someone in-house working on that permanently, because it just wouldn't be, they wouldn't be busy all the time. So, you know, I go to specialists for certain things. I go to a specialist, UX designer for work that we need for online, you know, a specialist, as I said, packaging designer, specialist photographers. Both the internal team and also the agencies that we work with is all one big team. We don't really kind of differentiate between, right, you are external, we treat you differently. You know, everybody is part of the Eve team, regardless of whether you work at Creature, you know, the agency that we work with on the Switch Off campaign, or whether it's, you know, Good Stuff, our media agency, we are all one team. And that, I think that's one thing that we did brilliantly well at the AA. And one thing that we do brilliantly well here is, you know, bring everybody in and everybody works together and everyone's kind of got access to everybody else's skills.
Well, let's talk about the latest campaign. And I mistakenly understood from the PR, as I confessed when we first met each other, that you decided to throw away Sloth, which genuinely I was upset by. And I'm not being sycophantic. I think you can tell that. I think Sloth is one of the most distinctive campaigns I've seen in a long time. But you've reassured me Sloth hasn't gone. So, Cheryl, tell me about the strategy behind this new campaign.
Yeah, so, I mean, look, we kind of, when we think about advertising, we sort of, let's talk about above the line advertising and sort of campaign line advertising. As you know, we kind of needed to work at three levels. We kind of need very, very hard working direct response advertising that works in daytime TV, and it tells you, look, sale now on, delivery tomorrow, you know, the really hard working conversion stuff. Then we need stuff that grows our brand, but grows our brand fairly close to the product. So, you know, this is the best beds, the best matches, is going to make you wake up feeling amazing, wake up ready to dance, which is what the Sloth campaign does. And as you grow a brand, you kind of want to get beyond your product into a broader brand positioning, because that's what then lets you support a bigger strategy. And that's what we're trying to do. Is when you introduced at the beginning as a mattress company, I had a slight we're not a mattress company, we're a sleep wellness business. We're much more than a mattress company. Absolutely, mattresses is the majority of what we sell, but it's by no means everything. And in 5 years' time, it really, really mustn't be, or else the business won't get to where the business needs to get to, and the brand won't be as strong as the brand needs to be. So the third layer, or the highest order layer, if you like, is true brand advertising, which is fairly agnostic of product and talks much more about the benefit your brand will give. You know, and like, you can think about the Coca-Cola truck, you can think about you know, the Lloyd's Galloping Horse, you can, you know, I mean, I don't need to tell you what a, you know, you can think about the John Lewis Christmas ad. I don't tell you what brand advertising looks like. For a small business to get to brand advertising can feel quite indulgent. So the Switch Off campaign should sit as that very top layer above the really great sort of product advertising, which is what the Sloth does. It's kind of a really nice, you know, product benefit ad, and the hard working DR, which is also Sloth-esque. And then Switch Off goes, actually, this brand is to help you sleep better and wake up feeling even better. And that's the campaign. And it's crafted in a really, really nice way. And you're all credit to Creature, who've done an amazing job. There's a few questions I asked them. You know, we are a young business, and the world is changing, and everyone feels very unsettled at the moment. And one of the questions I asked is, how can we give a campaign that gives a real sense of reassurance? And so we borrowed the clothes of some really historic cues. And as soon as you see that, you're like, God, this is a familiar thing. This isn't a scary e-commerce brand. This is something that's clearly very British and culturally relevant. So that's why we used that lovely test card F, as it is. And then the way it's laid down, so we're using it every Sunday night, which is the moment, the most difficult night's sleep you have is a Sunday night, because you've had a weekend of disruptive routine, you've probably been drinking, you're a bit worried about Monday morning. And we know it's the night people struggle to switch off most. It's also the most important night's sleep, if you can measure a night as most important, because you have to get up in the morning. So we're running it every Sunday night on TV, BVOD. And then there's a load of supporting stuff that goes through all sorts of other channels, and loads of lovely social and all sorts of things behind it.
So when a smaller brand, using your words, comes to the conclusion that brand is important, how difficult is it to persuade investors, particularly, who may not be, you know, native marketers, that this is an important part of your strategy?
I don't know, because I've never worked in a brand that hasn't considered brand important, or else I wouldn't take the job. Sort of no one employs me because they don't think brand's important. They employ a different sort of person. I'm a brand marketer. I build brands. I turn brands around. I transform brands. That's what I've always done. So I've never had to face into that. Every job I've come into is someone saying, we know brand is important. We know it's the biggest asset. You know, how do we make it amazing? A brand like Eve, if you really look at the business, it's only made up of the front end, if you like. We don't own our own factories. You know, we don't own our own foamers. We don't make our own product. We design our own product, but we have partners make them for us. Our skills all sit from product design forwards. So product design, customer experience, sales and marketing. And brand, therefore, our brand, is the single biggest asset we have as a business, actually. Well, our brand and our people are the two assets. So my job as a CEO, basically, at Eve, is to grow our people so they're brilliant and provide an amazing service for customers, and grow our brand so it's brilliant and attracts millions of customers. And that's kind of where the job sits. So there's never been a conversation with investors going, why are you building your brand? It's like, well, if I'm not building that, then what would you want to build? There's nothing else to build for our business. But it helps that we have the two best mattresses in the country, according to Which, you know, so we have amazing products.
And we've used the word distinctive quite a bit. And, you know, we're taught that distinctiveness is an important prerequisite to effectiveness. So how effective has Sloth been for you?
I think it's difficult to define, actually. So from an ROI point of view, very strong. It's a change in strategy. So the biggest impact is the change in a media strategy. It's slightly hard to isolate the creative impact and the media impact, but the whole thing has been very successful. When we test it in things like System One, it's a good strong ad. It's a 4.2, 4.3 star ad, so it's right up there. But I think the most powerful thing for Sloth for us in the UK has been the way, and Caroline's probably better to speak to this than me, so I might let her just chip in, but the way it's been able to bring all of our creative together. So not only are we distinctive, but we're also consistent, and that means the brand becomes more powerful at every touch point. Caroline, I don't know if you want to add a bit on that.
Absolutely. What it's enabled us to do is run that kind of threads of the campaign through, you know, our tone of voice, talking about, so that, you know, at the heart of the ads is you get a great night's sleep and you wake up dancing, the sloth wakes up dancing. And that's allowed us to weave a lot of that kind of language into all of our customer communications. It's a really distinctive image as well, and making sure that, you know, when we are above the line, that we use the sloth on the website, we use that language to talk about kind of waking up dancing, good morning twinkle toes, all of that sort of thing, doing the cha-cha-cha. It's enabled us to just build a really distinctive brand across every kind of touch point that we have, which has been an absolute dream. And that consistency, I think, when you work in a young brand, it's, you know, even more important to just nail that consistency time and time and time again, and really builds who we are. You know, it's going to be many a year and many, many millions of pounds spent before we can start moving away from our distinctive brand assets. I'm constantly trying to make sure that we are always delivering that consistent brand to our customers.
You guys kind of don't own bedtime or nighttime. You own the morning, right? Mm-hmm. That's your area, and that's a much more positive place to play. And does that I think is distinctive to you guys. I don't think any of the other mattress brands focus as heavily as you guys do on. And obviously, you've got the brand palette and all this kind of stuff. So it all is that kind of, it's a much more sort of interesting place to communicate.
It is, and it's quite. I love because I'm quite sad. I love watching our competitors try and copy us. I regularly see some of our competitors who shall remain nameless pop up with lines around waking up feeling good and having better mornings. And they've written that line on their standard template, which is a picture of a nighttime with the blue and the dark. And I'm like, it's not about It's not about some words. The brand is rooted in the morning. It is yellow. Our logo is a sun. All our language is about dancing and energy. All of our creative guardrails talk about filling you with positivity and a feeling of effortless capability. Like, the whole brand is about sleep wellness. It's how you feel when you wake up well slept. That is what the brand sits on. So it doesn't matter what words. I mean, Casper wrote in their IPO paper, or their latest results paper, that they were a sleep wellness business. I'm like, well, fine, but being a sleep wellness business means it's about the wellness, not the sleep. And they're not, they're rooted in the sleep.
Caroline, just a quick question. When I introduced you, I mentioned that you'd worked in non-profit, you'd worked at the BHF. How have you found what the main differences are creatively between not-for-profit and the commercial sector? Do you think there's anything that the two can learn from each other? Because we've worked with a lot of non-profits, and we also work with commercial. And I find it really challenging. As a creative lead, I find it really difficult to sort of like to flip between two different types of campaign. How have you found that sort of shift?
So when I was at the British Heart Foundation, I was really lucky in that I headed up the brand advertising. So led on, you know, creating the above the line campaign and then across all different channels, and actually had a really substantial budget to be able to do that. And everybody that I was working with incredible agencies, really experienced people. You know, we had econometrics, we had all the things that you would immediately kind of go, you know, there, you wouldn't assume that a charity not-for-profit would have all of those things in place. It was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. But on the flip side, you've got areas of the business who are, you know, have got the kind of fundraising challenges, who have a very different mindset. So you've got this constant kind of battle between building the brand, but also, working with people who have a different objective, really, and almost see brand advertising as a bit of a waste of money. So being able to, you know, give all of those people the results and say, actually, this directly correlates, the brand advertising directly correlates to the donations that we receive. It was really, really important. So I don't think I had a not-for-profit experience in the way that a lot of people would assume that it was a not-for-profit experience. You know, my budgets there were comparable to the budgets I then worked with at the AA, I think even greater. So it wasn't... But I also then consciously decided that my next role, I didn't want to work for a not-for-profit. I then consciously moved out of that world, because I wanted to build a far broader career. I think it was a brilliant experience, and I think standing up in front of, I think in my first week, you know, I had to stand up in front of 500 people and explain, you know, the brand campaign that we were doing and why we were doing it. And you're constantly reporting back to the whole of the business. Everyone is so invested because a lot of the people who worked at the British Heart Foundation had real personal reasons for working there, so they're even more invested. And everything that we did had to be able to directly correlate that with the donations that we were being able to get in, which then would pay for the research. So it was just so ingrained in you. There was no kind of vanity projects at all. It was all, we're doing these things and every penny matters. We are watching what we're doing with every tiny little thing.
So Cheryl, you've made that very unusual shift from CMO in an organization to CEO in the same organization. I have to ask you, how has the transition been, and what CMO skills do you think have been really useful as now the leader of the organization?
One thing I do think I've been reflecting on, we need to check the data on how unusual it is. So I keep seeing the data that, you know, one in five, and I'm like, one in five feels of CEOs or CMOs are from market background. That feels about right, actually, just by the by. So at some point, and I realise that's going to upset, you know, lots of my colleagues who don't feel there's enough marketeers at the top of business, and I think that's, you know, perhaps that is the case with the consumer businesses, but we do need to check the data. So what CMO skills have been most useful as a CEO? I mean, look, I'm a CEO of a marketing brand customer-led business. So I'm not sure what background will be a more useful background for leading this. This is not a business that's led by finance. Other businesses are led by finance for very good reasons because of how they're structured. Other businesses are led by operations because, you know, they're operationally driven businesses or, you know, or even technology driven businesses. But we are a business that's driven by customer obsession, product and our brand and marketing. So kind of all the skills that have stood me in good stead to get me where I am today are the same skills that have kind of put me in this seat, really. I think, you know, understanding the customer, being generally pretty strategic and being able to balance sort of risks which are inherent in marketing because everything you do hasn't been done before or it won't be successful. So that's really important as a CEO. And being able to communicate. Marketeers generally in a business are the best communicators because it's kind of the trade. And it's really, really key as a CEO, particularly as a CEO of a sort of small business where actually any one person out of kilter with the business has a very big impact, a disproportionate impact. So keeping everyone together and understanding where we're going and talking is really key. I'm quite a human people kind of first leader, I suppose. I mean, I'm developing people and understanding the skills and talents that I've got to work with and using them to their best ability. And that's what a marketer does. I mean, as a marketer, you're looking, you know, what you're looking for in an agency, I'm looking for complementary skills. What you look for in your people, complement, you know, balancing a team and balancing a breadth of skills and styles is a big part of being a good marketeer, actually, more so than I think in other disciplines, and that's key for being a CEO. I don't know, Caroline, what do you think I bring to me? Let's ask Caroline.
What do I think you bring? I think absolutely you are above everything else a people person. Relationships and understanding how the business works together, people work together, is vital and, you know, kind of top of the thing. I think also having seen you at the AA and also seeing you here, you know the story that you've got to be reporting on and answering and giving to certainly the executives at the AA. You know, you always back everything up by data.
And Caroline, while she's talking, how is it having such an experienced marketer as the boss?
It's a combination of
intimidating.
I know that Cheryl like absolutely knows exactly what we're trying to achieve. I don't have to do any convincing about whether what we're doing is the right thing. You know, there's a reason I follow Cheryl from the AA to Eve, because she's just a boss of a lifetime. I've learned so much and I'm kind of continuing to learn so much from her without sounding like it's kind of a combination of amazing but also slightly intimidating because I'm constantly thinking, you know, I think she's awesome, absolutely awesome.
Hey, back at you, girl.
I can see you blushing, actually. even though it's Zoom, Cheryl Calverly, you are blushing.
And I don't blush very easily, so that's, yeah. Although we did win the exec quiz last night, and I might have had a glass of wine or two to celebrate. So,
yeah, well done.
Post-wine blush.
Well done.
What we're going to talk about next is something a bit new. Slightly sort of interesting in terms of sort of we've never done it before. And what we've done is we've done a bit of background research of the category, which we can then share with our listeners and discuss with you. So how we did is we've got a sort of a partner agency called Human Theory, who are sort of, you know, specialize in sort of garnering sort of social data and sort of sentiment and understanding exactly sort of what people are saying about brands. They've given us an understanding of what's happening in your category through the eyes of the consumers. So they are data scientists, and they use AI to deliver qualitative insight at quantitative scale. And we picked out two areas to discuss.
Well, you'll be pleased to hear the first is sleep. And I kind of knew you were going to tell me off for calling you a mattress brand, but I thought I'd choose the words that the consumer possibly sees you as. And yeah. I know you aspire to be more than that. So I wasn't being that thick. So our chums at Human Theory found that 49% of all consumer conversations are, unsurprisingly, about around getting better sleep. And consumers are really crying out for help here. They're talking about the benefits of better sleep, the consequences of not getting good sleep. And there they discuss factors like work and family and stresses. They understand the importance of wellness, obviously, overall. But only a very small part of that conversation is about the bed and the bedroom. So why is that, do you think? And what role can a brand like Eve Sleep authentically play in helping us get more good sleep?
Look at that. I love it when data comes together. So that's exactly what we know and understand. So, and we haven't used AI shuddy. We've just spent some time talking to people in a room, but glad to see old techniques and new techniques hanging together. So absolutely, when you talk to people about sleep, right, what they get to, my mind is worrying, I wake up in the middle of the night, I can't drop off, I've got insomnia, I'm worried about the kids, worried about job, worried about money, worried about my health, worried about my partner's health. Then you come down a level, they might be too hot, too cold, room's cluttered, it's light, it's noisy, kids are waking them up, possibly there's some physical pain around their own body. And it's almost like an inverted pyramid, right? You've kind of got a narrowing funnel of the scale of the problem. And right at the very bottom of that is, I could do with a new mattress or a new bed or a new pillow or whatever. And so the sort of scale of that problem is pretty small, because, and it's a really easy problem to solve. It's like, I'll go and get a new mattress or bed or pillow. Whereas the scale of the, I can't go to sleep because I'm really worried about my job, kids, whatever, is massive. And, you know, in your 49% of people, you've probably got 48.9 talking about that, and much harder to solve. You can't go, well, I'll just get a new job then, or I'll just make the kids better. And so that's what we, and when we talk about becoming a sleep wellness business and we talk about our strategy, that's exactly what we're trying to do. We're here to help give people the sleep they need to rise and shine. And we know full well that mattresses aren't enough. They're bloody, don't get me wrong, if you haven't got a good mattress, you won't sleep, like, no matter how calm your mind is. So actually, it's fundamental. But it won't solve the problem for most people, which is why part of the reason we have the switch off campaign is to try and step up and go, right, well, let's help encourage people to turn off their TV at 5 to 11 and not watch, you know, the next Netflix episode, and go and switch off. And you'll see this campaign evolve, and it talks about blue light, and it talks about white noise, and it talks about nature sounds. It's got a whole series of things to help with that switch off moment, because switching off is one of those problems that a lot you'll have seen in your data. A lot of people talk about, I just can't switch off. We as a business have a very clear strategy to go to expand our service that we give customers. So, you know, we started as a mattress, we expanded into beds and bedding, and we've got a little bit of bedroom furniture, which helps to deal with clutter. We are expanding into much more content and supporting content. So we've got a project with Analog Folk, which we kicked off about 3 or 4 months ago, to really build out that supporting content and help people tackle some of those other sleep wellness problems. Absolutely, that data that you're seeing is what we're building our brand strategy on. And that's why, you know, today we are a mattress brand, but in 5 years' time, we will be a sleep wellness business. And, you know, we're kind of slowly getting there. We've launched some nice bedroom stuff, which is one step out into environment with Boots, the Well Select range. So we're slowly getting there, but it's investment, it's time, and we have to walk customers there as a brand. We can't just rock up and say we're the experts in, you know, winding down yet.
One of the other things that Human Theory is sort of insight is telling us is that people just don't really understand how uncomfortable their bed is when it's often a remote purchase. How do you communicate comfort effectively?
Oh, Caroline, go on. You can't go on that one. It's really hard, is the answer.
It's really hard. It is really, really hard. I mean, I think we do it in a few different ways. So we use our own customers. The data that we collect from our customers. So we survey our customers and we say, how much difference has Eve Sleep made to how well slept you feel each morning? And we know that 8 out of 10 people sleep better on an Eve. So that's you know, we use that in our direct response advertising. And we use it in our performance advertising, that kind of message. We also have, you know, Trustpilot reviews across our site. We're really transparent about the Trustpilot reviews that we receive. And we also have, as Cheryl mentioned at the beginning, Witch Awards, as well. So, and we've got the, you know, two best mattresses in the UK, best on test. So those things all kind of slightly ladder up to convince people that we will give them a, you know, that our mattresses are comfortable. And I think just, you know, when you are making that remote purchase, we also have this 100 nights free trial, and we make it so, so simple for people to return their mattress. And throughout that whole 100 nights, you know, we're constantly kind of saying to them, now it's time to rotate your mattress. You know, we give them kind of all the information that they need about how long it's going to take for their bones to get used to a new mattress, all of that information. But you know what? If you get to 100 nights and you don't like it, that's not a problem. You can return the mattress. No questions asked. So we try and make it as simple as possible for people. I think that the convincing of a cup of comfort, I think, is, you know, we talk about, we use a lot of, you know, our copy, the tone of voice throughout of all of our website is beautifully written, and, you know, talks about sublimely comfortable mattresses and heavenly pillows, and, you know, that will do a certain job. I think there's nothing quite like hearing it from our customers' mouths and actually giving them the kind of the facts.
And just to build on that, I think because I think you can have two approaches to returns as a business. You can see returns as a cost that you should try and avoid, or you can see returns as a customer that you've just not been quite right for. Now, if you're a sleep wellness business, one thing we do understand is sleep is totally personal. It's a bit like clothes, you know, not, you know, my jeans won't fit you two. We are here to help you sleep better. We're not here to make sure, not here to make you buy our mattress or keep our mattress. The most important thing to us is that you sleep better. So as a business, we are very, very proud when a customer says, wasn't right for me, I returned, but my goodness me, the return was so easy. And I've now got a better mattress and I'm sleeping better. That we look for that as an absolute priority. And I mean, this morning we have a hangout on a Friday. Now we're all remote, where we kind of talk about the wins for the week. And you know, our chief operating officer, yeah, we get him to read out some of his favorite Trustpilot reviews. And he almost always reads out a review talking about our amazing returns. It's something we're really, really proud of, because it means that the customer we've lived up to our promise, which is if it's not right, of course we'll take it back. And therefore you can relax and give it a go and test it out properly in home, not for 10 minutes in a store with some weird man standing over you trying to sell you an upgrade.
Yeah, interesting you said that sleep is very personal. And when I was digging into the data that we'd got, there was one interesting trigger. I don't think it was by any means the biggest trigger for considering buying a new mattress, which was a new partner, which is quite an intimate thing, isn't it? So how far can a brand go in areas like that, do you think?
We have discussed whether we should do a tie-up with divorce lawyers, but I think it's probably pushing it a little bit far. we wouldn't sort of get explicit. I mean, we've got some stuff coming out, actually. Caroline, you might want to talk about stuff we've got coming out, which is to fit around partners a little better.
Yeah, so we've got a partner duvet that we're launching next year. So you've got different togs on each side, because we know that, you know, to be totally stereotypical, women like to be warmer and men like to be cooler. Different people like different duvet weights. So that's one of the things that we're doing. We also know that kind of convincing your partner of buying a new mattress can take a little bit of work. So we make sure that we give, you know, all of the reasons, almost kind of the argument that you can go back with. Well, you know, why not? Let's just try it. You know, we have got 100 nights. If it's not for us, we can return it. You know, we talk about how long it takes to get used to the mattress, as I said already. So all of those things, you know, we try and just, you know, anything that you need to kind of convince your partner that it's the right thing. And also a lot of the content, as Cheryl was saying, that we've got, you know, we bring out, might talk about different types of sleepers, what you might need and all that sort of thing.
We know there are a number of triggers for buying a new mattress. I mean, buying a new home, kids leaving home and sort of reformatting your home, getting divorced, unfortunately, getting married. You know, there's loads of triggers and you know, we sort of use those judiciously where we target marketing. Don't overuse them, because everyone will buy a new mattress at some point in the next couple of years.
So the next big thing that came up in the analysis was around conversations to do with sustainability, which is a really interesting one because obviously, you know, I know that IKEA have like toyed with the idea of a more circular approach to some of their sort of, you know, to sofas and what have you, and some of their and some of the other things they sell. And but there does seem to be a lack of understanding of the sustainability of the mattress, of the product itself, and in some cases, confusion over how people should behave. How are you guys approaching that? And like, how do you think the sort of category should be improving its sort of messaging around sustainability?
Well, I think, look, messaging around sustainability is not what I'm particularly interested in. What I'm interested in is sustainability.
You know, actual.
Messaging follows what you do, not it shouldn't precede it.
Yeah.
And I think we've got a load of stuff that we need to work through as an industry and as a category. And, you know, I'll speak honestly for us, as we're only just starting on this journey, but we are very much on the journey. We've got an excellent recycling partner. So every mattress that comes back to us gets either refurbished or recycled. We don't send anything to landfill. It's really important for us. But of course, not every Eve mattress will come back to us at the end of its life. So we're just kicking off quite a few projects to see how we can get to a much more circular, either circular or genuinely recyclable approach. You know, there is a big question about foam, full stop. And you know quite where foam goes, because foam is a pet chem. It's not a terribly environmentally friendly product. And whilst you can do all you can to work on the recycling and the reuse of that, I think in the long term it'll be interesting to see whether foam as a portion of the category declines significantly.
Again, digging into the data, I saw that there were quite a few conversations that were suggesting, this is the wrong vocabulary, but they were kind of thinking that this category is a bit like, or becoming a bit like the fast fashion, and that we've created a bit of a disposable attitude to mattresses. How can we respond to that?
That's interesting. So I've not, that would be a very nuanced. We're seeing no increased turnover in mattress purchasing. You know, we'd love, people should be buying new mattresses a little more often than they do. And whilst everyone talks that every 8 years, on average, any one mattress is changed about every 13 years, which means you're probably spending at least 3 or 4 years damaging your health on that. So look, I would be very uncomfortable at a comparison to fast fashion. I don't think not changing my tank top fast enough is going to fundamentally increase my risk of dementia, cancer, obesity, anxiety. I think it's a very different thing. So I'd love to see that data a little more and see how much of an issue that is in consumers' minds, but it's not a thing. I suspect it's to do with the category behaviours as well of D2C mattresses. So, I mean, the biggest mattress brand in the UK is IKEA. That's where most people buy a mattress. Argos, loads of people, but Dreams, Beds and the Beds. I mean, this is where the country is buying mattresses, not on Facebook. But you won't find IKEA, Argos, Benson's of Beds or Dreams chasing you around Facebook endlessly because they're not indulging in this kind of D2C behavior. But what you will, if you go and Google a mattress, you'll be hit on Facebook with Otti, Simba, Emma, Nectar. You probably won't be hit by us because I don't think it's brand building behavior. So we'll be quite careful what we might talk to you about. But you can feel like there is a proliferation, I think, of mattress brands. I mean, there aren't. So you go into Dreams, if you go on the Dreams website, they've still got 900 mattress brands on there. You know, that's where the mattresses are sitting, you know, but those brands are not targeting you on Facebook.
Let's go back to creativity. I can tell that's an area that you're both very passionate about. Caroline, as the creative director, no pressure. The signature question of the Wax Lyrical podcast is, what is your favourite TV ad? It's over to you now. And because we're audio, when you divulge what your favourite ad is, please give us a bit of a picture in words to remind us, for those of us who may not have seen it.
Okay, so I don't think there's many people who wouldn't have seen this. And I feel really predictable. When you pose this question, you know, I think it's a really difficult question for somebody who works in advertising, because I think you always feel like you need to give some, you know, incredible answer that is, you know, ultimately my favourite TV ad is Monty the Penguin, John Lewis ad from 2014.
All my little plans and schemes lost like some forgotten dream. Seems like all I really was doing was was waiting for you.
It's a boy. I've got a son. Makes me think of him. It just gets me emotionally. I love the music. Music is so, so important. We know it's so, so important. And it just gets me. And it's, I think, that real understanding of, you know, brand advertising being so, it's so important that it draws emotion from you is so important. And I think I also love it because I think it was 4 years into their Christmas ads and you kind of, the anticipation was building, and I just have a memory of watching it at the agency that I was at the time over the shoulder of one of the creatives and just watching it, and we watched it again and again and we talked about it, and that hadn't happened really before. You know, it sort of had been building a little bit for the year before or so, but just that emotion, and it still gets me now. And I'm not an emotional person at all, so to get to get a reaction from me is quite difficult. But I just love it. I love it, and that's at the heart of good advertising, surely.
Yeah, Ben and I were chatting about it because you had given me a preview that you were going to choose that. And I think you're right, Ben. It was probably that scenario you painted, Caroline, of standing in the office. You knew the ad was coming. I bet that ad fulfilled and probably exceeded your expectations. Fast forward to 2020, I'll be honest, that's no longer happening for me. My expectations are no longer being exceeded by the ads. And I think that's why that one in 2014 was so special. Was it a real penguin? Does anybody know? Or was it all CGI? I'm serious.
It's all CGI.
Was it?
Very brilliant Mill, who also did our AO ad.
You're joking.
No, I loved it. I had a tear in my eye, definitely, the first time I saw it. But as the planner, let me just remind us, it really worked. I mean, it's become a case history in integration. I think it was the first year where they had every shop window of, I think there were about 44 John Lewis's in the UK. Every John Lewis in every city had Monty in the window, and you could get a Monty storybook, and there was Monty everything.
And I think you could sponsor a penguin as well.
Yeah.
London Zoo or something. Amazing.
So, and in the case...
It was also their slightly difficult second album in a kind of way. Yeah. It was 4 years in. I think, like, how do you sustain that? That's tough. That's really tough.
And they were in that purple patch, weren't they? So you had like Bear in the Hair, you had the Snowman, and they had like four or five in a row where it was just like, this is a genuinely big deal, part of popular culture, what advertising used to be like, and this is the sort of like the best example of it. And it's impossible. It's a too big a thing to sustain. I mean, I think like they've done an amazing job, but yeah, I think it probably peaked at Monty. And so, like, what about yourself? Like, you know, what's your favourite TV ad, and why? Please, give us the lowdown.
It's hard to separate yourself, even as a marketeer, a professional, from the quality of advertising. So it's a bit like, I have to go for myself. And actually, I reflect the advertising when I kind of got into the industry is the stuff that I remember most because it was I was in it. And I worked on Pop Noodle just at the end of Slagable Snacks. And so sort of all that very cultural, you know, Tango, Reebok with Belly, all that kind of really funny, really edgy stuff was very, very in my mind. So I think I'd probably call out Tango, definitely. And then you go, right, where do you start? You know, the Slap was amazing. Hit the Whole Fruit. I absolutely loved Hit the Whole Fruit. That whole kind of range, probably the oranges one when the diver's helmet comes and it goes, oh, there's a helmet full of fun right there. It's brilliant. helmet full of pleasure right there. What a line. What a freaking line. And then I think Blackcurrant Tango is, I think, yeah. with the Cliffs of Dover, and you know, you, me, right here, right now.
Come on then, Sebastian. Come on.
so much, you know, great, stupid, fun, really different advertising knocking about in that late 90s. And I do think we have lost, I mean, that's what I think needs to come next, because we've been through this wonderful period of big emotional narratives, you know, and my God, you can look back at Gorilla was amazing, and that kind of kicked off this whole thing, and we understand a bit of a formula that works, at least the linear, at least we're slightly out of the tangential stories and a bit more of a linear narrative. But how do we get forward from here? Because we've definitely got ourselves in a little bit of a rut. And if I look at the last, to your point, last couple of years of advertising, and I think about what stood out as feeling different or like it's starting a new trend. I mean, I think IKEA Christmas last year felt quite different, which is really interesting, exciting. Everything else, whilst loads of wonderful advertising, felt a little bit formulaic. Similar to the Virgin stuff, which was the Virgin Broadband stuff with the nodding heads. With the scouts.
That beat's amazing to it. Yeah.
So stuff like that, yeah. I think is, you know, and stuff, the stuff that Wydens were doing with Three, before Wydens lost it, with, you know, phones are good. I think we do need to get to a little bit, some different, much more edgy stuff, which I think that gives a hint of, but that's where we need to go next, I think. It's all feeling a bit smooshy and safe at the moment.
The ad that you picked, Cheryl, I guess is so, it's gone down in history. It's got its own name. It's called St. George.
Blackcurrant has become known
as St. George, a bit like a movie that got posthumously named. It's from 1996. Yes,
there. So I was in Pot Noodle, 2002, 2003, and we were working with HUCL, and, you know, working with them on the back end of the slag campaign, and they'd done that tango stuff. It was a really special time. I mean, I know you always look back with like rose tinted, but my God, it was a good fun time to be in marketing. I mean, it was interestingly, it was a very, very effective campaign, but at the same time, what people don't know, I'm a real effectiveness geek, you have to bear with me, is there's a massive repositioning of tangos. They've repackaged all of the product, they changed a load of their product lines, they've got a whole load of new distribution, a whole load of change of promotional strategy, and the campaign came out. So the ROI on that whole piece was phenomenal.
I think you could tell. I'd love to chat to you two for a while. And I'm not just saying this. I can see, because I can see you, sadly, we're audio. There's a real partnership here, which is quite precious. So congratulations on what you've achieved so far. I'm delighted that Sloth will continue. I hope there'll be another episode in the Sloth saga. So
do we.
Thank you so much for chatting. I've really enjoyed. I've learned an awful lot from you both today. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
It's been great. Thanks, guys.
And hopefully we'll see you soon.
Yes,
for sure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.